You take your Bibles, please, and turn to Philippians chapter 1. Philippians 1, and I will read verses 9 through 11. Philippians 1, 9 through 11. And this I pray, that your love may abound still more and more in real knowledge and discernment, so that you may approve the things that are excellent in order to be sincere and blameless until the day of Christ, having been filled with the fruit of righteousness which comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God.
Thank you, Rick. Past couple years, I've often said that if I ever wrote a book, at least a nonfiction book, I would call it Forgotten Virtues. You know, there are several virtues in our world, in our nation, in our culture that are often well praised. You know, we celebrate strength and courage and honor, charisma, goodness, honesty, fairness, and that kind of virtue. And yet, there are often virtues that fall by the wayside, that are not as well praised, not as well sought by members of our society. Virtues like humility and hospitality and kindness. Virtues like patience and charity and wisdom. There are those related virtues of temperance and chastity and contentment. We know these are virtues, but we don't often celebrate them. We don't even sometimes know what some of them mean. And these are virtues that I would want to promote in a society. But then there's today's subject, which is discernment. 1,600 years ago, a great Christian writer called discernment the, quote, mother, the guardian, and the guide of all the virtues. It was John Cashin. Discernment, he reasoned, was absolutely needed. If you were going to have any other virtue in life, if you were going to have any other virtue active in your life towards others, you needed discernment. Otherwise, that virtue, that other virtue, could not come to maturity or even last long. We all want to be good people, but it is discernment that enables us to know the difference between what is good and what is evil. It's only through discernment that we can tell what is wisdom and what is foolishness. It's only discernment that gives us a real distinction between courage and presumption. It's discernment that enables us to see the difference between leadership and manipulation. Discernment is especially needful in our society today. We are constantly bombarded with conflicting messages. We need to be able to discern which one is right. We need discernment so that we can know what is best and may be pure and blameless until the day of Christ, as Philippians says. In a world of mixed messages and changing values and conflicting reports, we need more than ever to be able to answer this one very important question: how do we know what is true? Previously, years passed, generations passed, we would read the newspaper, or we'd turn on the news, and Walter Cronkite would tell us what is true, and we would be able to trust it. Now, if you don't know who Walter Cronkite was, I can't help you. YouTube it. You'll be able to see, right? Walter, he would tell us what is happening, and that would satisfy our curiosity about the news. We'd know what is true. For more complex issues, we'd go to school, we'd learn, we'd read a book, and we would find out what our teacher tells us, and we'd know then what is true. These, alongside many others, were sources that were trustworthy. The information would flow into our lives, and we could accept what was said, but recently the world's gotten more confusing. It's gotten more complex, have you noticed? Conflicting reports abound. Terms like fake news are thrown around constantly, and mistrust, even in our most basic institutions, is everywhere. Some of us conclude that anything that is reported by a certain type of source, usually a source that's identified with the other side, not our tribe, the other guys. That must automatically be suspect, and anything reported by the side we've chosen, well, that's right and true and faithful. Others take a page out of the ancient skeptics. I'm not going to trust anything. I'm going to vow not to believe anything until I can test and prove it myself. Many in our culture have a basic mistrust today of anyone who carries the name expert. Being an expert used to be a good thing. If I was an expert in my field, I'd be trusted in my field. That used to be a good thing. You would be more trustworthy simply because you had those letters after your name, or because you've spent all of your life discovering certain things. But somehow that's changed. In our world, anymore, it seems like there's an automatic mistrust of experts. Automatically, there are hordes of people in our world that if someone is promoted as an expert, they say, well, then I can't trust him or her. There's a fear, maybe, that there's an agenda that they have to twist and distort or even entirely hide the truth. And so we don't accept what the expert tells us and think we can do our own research and better understand what is true in every area of life. And maybe that's right. Or maybe we can, at times, arrogantly overestimate our own ability to understand complex issues and information, dismissing someone's life work simply because we don't understand it. So how can we know what is true? How can we know what is good and right and proper? How can we tell the difference between truth and falsehood, pride and humility, knowledge and ignorance? How can we tell? How can we discern properly? We need to, because discernment is the mother of all the virtues. Discernment is that ability that gives birth to all the others, that gives us the ability to make good judgment. Discernment keeps us from blundering into foolish actions and evil works and hurtful words. Discernment allows us to hold on to what is right. And the Bible is full of calls to discernment. Like Romans 12, 2 says, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, and then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. Now, discernment is not a word in that verse, but that verse is all about discernment. To test and approve what God's perfect will is, we need to reject what is wrong and sinful and false and approve what is good and right and true. We need this. We need discernment. Yet so very few of us know how to do it very well. We might trust the wrong voices because we can't tell the difference between an objective fact and something we simply want to be true. We can be misled. All of us are capable of being misled. But Ephesians 4:25 calls us to a higher thing. It says, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbor. That's a great ideal. To put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbor is a necessary thing. That's what I want to be. But how can we do that? Especially if we lack discernment. Before we can put off falsehood, we must be able to tell the difference between what is false and what is true. A Christian, therefore, has a calling, a high and holy calling to take this seriously and to do good work in this area, to be committed to what is true first and foremost, to avoid all falsehood, and from that place to live like Jesus. And this has become increasingly difficult in our culture. We are overwhelmed with these outright contradictory messages. How can we decide between them what is true? Well, to help in today, I want to give a discernment principle, first off. And then from there, give some good discernment practices. The discernment principle is first. Here it is. Be a jurist, not an advocate. This is courtroom language, and it's quite appropriate because courtrooms are where truth goes to be tried, right? Discernment is meant to be employed in a courtroom so that you can separate fact from fiction and find the wisest course of action. That's the ideal of a courtroom. And in every courtroom, there are different types of people. There are people with different roles, and they behave, because they have different roles, in very different kinds of ways, particularly toward the evidence that is brought forward and considered. An advocate comes into a courtroom with a conclusion already formed. An advocate is like the defense lawyer, or, alternately, the prosecuting attorney. Now, their job is to present the best possible case they can for their side. Therefore, they're always looking for ways to use whatever evidence comes up, they're always looking for ways to use that evidence to advance their agenda, to support their case. It is the job of the defense lawyer to prove their client is not guilty, to cast doubt upon any evidence that would seek to show that he is guilty. The prosecutor's job is to prove that the defendant is guilty, and so they will use whatever evidence there is to try to prove that point. Each advocate walks into the courtroom with their minds already made up. So it doesn't matter what the evidence actually is. They will find a way to say that the evidence supports their case. If you watched Perry Mason or any courtroom dramas, you know what this looks like as the attorneys battle back and forth. So the advocate is willing to overlook evidence if overlooking it supports their case, or to minimize evidence and say it's not really all that important after all, if that supports their case. Or they might make evidence look much more important than it actually is. Oh, this is huge. If it doesn't fit, it must acquit, right? This is what advocates do. Did anyone else get that? Okay, a few of us. Good. Whew, I saw some blank stares there, and I just didn't know if I'm the only one who watched that trial. So they will twist, and they will turn, they will dismiss and ignore evidence. Sometimes they outright lie in order to get the result that they want. The bottom line for an advocate is that they're not really there open to learning something. They are there trying to impose an agenda onto the evidence. They've already made up their minds before looking at the evidence. They've been hired to defend. All right, now show me the evidence and I will figure out how to use it to defend my client. Any evidence presented to the court must be made to support that conclusion. That's their job, to present the strongest case that they can for the outcome that they desire, right? Don't be an advocate. Alternately, be a jurist. The jurist, the ideal jurist, on the other hand, very different from the advocate. Think members of the jury here, okay? It would be entirely altogether wrong for a jury member to go into a courtroom with their minds already made up about the guilt of the accused. We don't want them decided ahead of time whether they're going to say guilty or innocent. We want them to be listening to the evidence. It's not the jury's job to argue for or against the defendant, but to evaluate the arguments that are being made by the prosecutor and defense team. To understand that there are slants and twisting of evidence that can be done, and make a fair evaluation between the arguments that are made. It is only after evaluating the evidence, only after evaluating the arguments, that the jury should come to a conclusion and reach a verdict. Their job as a jury is not to be partisan, not to take sides, but to fairly and carefully consider everything that goes on in the courtroom and discover what the truth really is. So the principle of good discernment is just that: be a jurist, not an advocate. Convictions are good. Our conclusions should be good. We should have convictions in our lives about things. But if If we get this wrong, we get this very wrong. Our convictions about what is true and good need to come after we evaluate the evidence that is available. Let me give you an illustration. Just a week ago, on October the 17th, there was an explosion in Gaza City at a hospital. You probably saw this in the news. What happened? Well, hundreds of people died in this explosion. That much was evident. It was obvious. That's the event that happened. But the question we want to ask is not just what happened in this terrible event of people dying at this hospital in Gaza, but who's to blame, right? Who's to blame? The Gazans were convinced that Israel had dropped a bomb on the hospital on purpose. The New York Times saw people in Gaza saying this, and so they reported that the bomb had come from Israel right away. Boom. On the other hand, the Israelis and many others in the West assumed it was a failed rocket launch from Gaza, that maybe they launched it from the hospital or maybe it fell, whatever it was. It wasn't us, it was them. Now, my point is not really about the facts of the case, but about the reactions. Many, many, many people around the world simply automatically knew what had happened, quite apart from any evidence. They knew who did this, not because of the evidence showing it, but they made conclusions because they had a narrative, a prejudice, a preconceived idea about who must be to blame for an atrocity. If an atrocity takes place in Gaza, who's to blame automatically? Who do we automatically say must have done it? This is one the New York Times got wrong. Had to admit they got wrong. It's a great example of how nobody in our society really needs a hot take before the facts are known. Indeed, drawing a conclusion and then making the facts fit that conclusion is quite damaging to this world. The rocket came from Gaza. It's been proved. It was Hamas, not Israel. But the reaction that people have is quite apart from the evidence. You see what I'm saying? If our convictions come prior to evaluating what is true, then we will inevitably be tempted to twist or deny the truth to conform to our convictions. We must be careful not to do this. To be a discerning person, we must become a jurist who is willing to follow the truth where it leads, wherever it leads, not an advocate seeking to bend all evidence to fit a preconceived idea, the conclusion that we want. Well, how do we do this? Let me give you some good discernment practices. I've got five of them. And the first one is absolutely the most important. Number one, learn to listen well. Be a good listener. This is absolutely vital. James 1:19 says, everyone, and if I'm not mistaken, that would include me, that everyone, and it would probably include you if you include yourself in the human race, everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. It's especially true when we are tempted to quickly leap to a conclusion and start arguing. We are in our society, in this nation, in this world, we are excellent at being quick to anger and quick to speak. We're not quite so good at being slow to speak, slow to anger, and quick to listen. Proverbs is replete with instructions to listen and to hold our tongues as much as possible. We would do well to listen to this advice. And to do this well, we need to get our information from multiple sources, from different people on different sides. We need to listen to everyone. So here's a really practical piece of advice. In listening well, don't watch only one news outlet or read only one newspaper, especially one that would be rather openly partisan. The more partisan one of these outlets is, the less we should listen to them. They are advocates as such. We should listen to perspectives we might tend to disagree with. We should get our news from a wide variety of sources. Otherwise, we will probably start acting more and more like advocates rather than jurists. Let me give you an example of what this can look like in practice. From my own life, I went to Asbury Theological Seminary. It's a great school, very evangelical, but it's a Methodist school, and that's not the tradition that I grew up with. I could have gone to other schools that align more closely to the theological tradition that I grew up with. I could have. But one of the reasons I decided to go to Asbury was because they would teach things that were different from the tradition I grew up with. For example, a Baptist school would have been much more closely aligned with the tradition I grew up with, and I would have not been exposed to the most passionately delivered and best arguments for subjects like, for example, infant baptism and whether women should be pastors. If I never heard the arguments for such things, though, I had to ask the question, would I really have rejected those kinds of doctrines or only rejected caricatures of those doctrines? I want to be exposed to the best arguments for everything and then be able to decide what the truth is, not be exposed only to a caricature of an argument. I was not afraid of what I might hear, because I want to know the truth and follow the truth wherever the truth leads. I'm on the side of truth, not on the side of a tradition I grew up with. You know? If it fits my preconceived notion, fine. If not, fine. Now, I came out of Asbury with great confidence, still, in most of the traditional areas that I grew up with. But I knew also that those ideas and doctrines that I grew up with were tested as thoroughly as they should be. And I knew it was true. This was a good thing. And plus, I came out with a little bit more understanding towards other traditions of Christianity and a little less doctrinal finger wagging, a little less judgmentalism towards those who did not grow up the same way I did. This was good. Likewise, those who would only get news from a rather progressive source, for example, would probably only ever be familiar with caricatures of conservative arguments, not with the real arguments themselves. And so they would not be well equipped to discern what wisdom and truth is, and that goes for the other side as well. It's only through listening that we can learn. Only the arrogant refuse to listen to others. Listening is an act of love and care for other people. Listening is needful for us to be discerning people. Secondly, look for multiple attestation. This is a really big way of saying if there's only one source or one piece of evidence, that may not be the best thing. If there's only one source for what I'm being told, and that's, you know, jimbobsblog.com, maybe, just maybe, it's not a good source. Maybe, just maybe, it could be true still, but it's less likely to be true. If you can find, though, two or three witnesses that support each other, you can gain more confidence in what you are reading. And this principle can help us look for proper reasons to believe what we believe. You know, there are many falsehoods that are out there that cry for our attention, and most of them have a story, but no support. The truth is supported by other witnesses, by scientific evidence, by logical reasoning, by expert testimony, and we should not fear these things because these things are avenues towards truth, and we should know them. Third, beware social media echo chambers. All right? Twitter, or what was formerly known as Twitter, X, Facebook, these have not been good to our society. They employ tools called algorithms that can severely distort how we see the world if we are not careful. Let me explain how that works. If you click on and watch a video of someone trying to tell you, for example, that the earth is flat, then Twitface will assume that you are very interested in that kind of video and start to give you more of it. And more of it. And more other things like it. Twitface makes lots of money this way. The problem is that eventually our entire feed is filled with things that you like. Pictures you like, videos that you like, news and stories that you like. Twitface becomes an advocate reinforcing our own prejudices. And we don't even notice it. Rarely does it challenge us to hear other perspectives. And we can get locked into this echo chamber that only ever reinforces this one perspective. That's unhealthy. It's not good for proper discernment. It's been bad for our society. Beware of it. Number four, beware social media, period. Not just the echo chambers. Many people get their opinions on things, like really honestly important things. We get our opinions on these things, our conclusions from these things, from memes rather than actual evidence. You know what a meme is? Here's one. Here's Jesus. "Let me in," Jesus says. "Why?" says the voice from inside. "So I can save you," says Jesus. "From what?" says the voice inside. "Well, from what I'm going to do to you if you don't let me in." Now, my friends, memes can be funny, they can be clever, they can be interesting ways of making an argument and a point. But this one is just the worst. I mean, that's just awful. It tells people this is what Christians teach, the dorks. Don't pay attention to Christianity. Look how stupid it is. That's what this says. But this is not Christianity. It does not represent Christianity well. It is a fundamental misrepresentation of Christian doctrine. It's not fair in the slightest way to Christianity. And yet people throughout our society see this type of thing and they say, I'm not going to be a Christian. That's dumb. Why would I believe that? We should never base what we think around what we find on social media. Never. It is far too easy for someone to make something up and splash it on Facebook or make it up and preach it on YouTube. Now, they can sound convincing, but many, many times it's just a misrepresentation of truth. The number of people in America who simply read or hear something on Twitface or YouTube or whatever else and just believe it is alarming. Alarming. Please don't get your news from Facebook. Number five, watch your own prejudices. We must decide to follow the truth wherever it leads, even if, and especially when, the truth is different than what you really want to believe. It's so very easy to evaluate evidence based on what we want to believe, rather than based on truth and wisdom. Remember, truth is always to be preferred over falsehood. A jurist is on the side of truth. We should not try to win an argument like an advocate. Watch your own prejudices. And let me just also take the time to say, we all have our own prejudices. Be aware of them. Let me give you an example. I was reading a sermon a number of weeks ago, months ago now probably, and it involved a Greek word. The sermon stuck out in my mind because the pastor who was preaching it got into the Greek. Now, I happen to know New Testament Greek somewhat well. I took 3 years of it in college. I love getting into New Testament Greek. Anyone else that kind of dork here? I'm the only one. That's fine. Tried to teach it to my wife a little bit. We got through the alphabet, not too much further. Anyway, so my interest peaks when I hear a pastor try to prove his point by using Greek grammar. When he says, "Let me take you to the Greek," I say, "Okay, let's go to the Greek." Now, this particular pastor in this particular moment was massively irresponsible in how he used the Greek language to support his point. I was astonished. I sat in my chair reading this saying, "How on earth can you think you can get away with this?" His sermon was about a particular doctrine. I won't get into what. His text just a bare reading of his text seemed to at least give a problem for the doctrine that he was trying to teach. If he accepted what every reputable scholar of the Greek New Testament, if he accepted what they say about this particular Greek word, his doctrine would be much more difficult to teach. It would be called into question. So what he did was simply reject what every expert said about the word, grasping instead upon a terribly unlikely interpretation of the word, advanced by someone who clearly did not understand Greek. His predetermined conclusion drove how he evaluated the evidence. He rejected some evidence in favor of the one that proved his point. He was willing to twist, deny, dismiss evidence simply because he had an agenda to teach. He was acting in that moment like a defense attorney trying to defend his point, making all the evidence fit his narrative. And he believed and taught what is not true from the Bible as a result. He should have been a jurist instead, evaluating the evidence objectively and just going where the evidence leads. If every Greek scholar agrees on the meaning of a word, if every commentator agrees on the meaning of a word, it probably gives you a good reason to accept their testimony. That's five discernment practices that can help us. Be a good listener, get multiple sources, beware echo chambers, beware social media, watch for prejudices. That's a place to start, right? Others could be mentioned. But there's one last thing I did want us to see before we're done today. And that comes directly out of Philippians chapter 1. And that is, there is good spiritual fruit that results from good discernment. Philippians 1, 9 through 11 tells us the kind of person that we become when we're engaged in good discernment. Let's read it again. And this is my prayer, that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and depth of insight, so that you may be able to discern what is best and may be pure and blameless until the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God. First, love needs to abound. This is the place we start, right? More and more. Here's the question, right? In my pursuit of knowing what is good, am I becoming more loving because of what I think is true? Am I growing in love in my pursuit of what is true in this world and in my pursuit of what is true in this book? Because I have seen it. Perhaps you have too. I have seen many people become much more fearful, much more angry, divisive, harsh, judgmental when they believe lies. Maybe you've seen that too. A Christian should be grounded in the truth, primarily, of course, in the Bible. That gives us a place to start. It's a message of fear not, not be afraid. It's a message of love your enemies, not hate them. It's a message of show grace, not be divisive. It's a message of blessed are the meek, blessed are the humble, not, hey, let's arrogantly throw ourselves over top of someone else. Discerning actual truth, discerning what is good apart from what is evil, discerning in this life ought to make us more loving, not less, and that should grow over time, more and more and more. Therefore, if we are becoming in any way less loving, well, to that extent, we're not using good discernment. Number two, knowledge, depth of insight is needed. I cannot have a bias against good thinking. We must not check our brains at the door of the church. Evidence, rigorous thinking, these are not suspect things. They are necessary. Too often, Christians have become anti-intellectual. We are called to knowledge and insight and to grow in that in every area of life. Discernment as a Christian is possible only as love and knowledge and insight increase. Love, knowledge, insight, we might say simply wisdom in that case, are the foundation of good and proper discernment. Love is first. Start there. Never leave there. Love God. Love others. Let that drive all that you do. and then grow in your knowledge of the Bible, of course, first, and then of all things. Grow in wisdom and insight, and discernment then leads us toward purity and righteous living. If we find that our increased knowledge in this world is making us cross lines that God has drawn, then we should confront the question of whether I've learned something true or whether I just want what I want and I'm looking for excuses to do it. If I'm becoming more angry and vengeful, more judgmental and harsh, if I'm unkind and ungracious and so on, then I'm not really involved in Christian discernment, because Christian discernment ought to lead me toward purity and righteous living. Beware of any truth, any idea, any belief, any doctrine out there. Beware of it if it allows you to dehumanize another person. So often we make others into enemies to be destroyed or problems to be solved rather than lost sheep that need to be found, people to be loved. The God of truth does not lead us to dehumanize our enemies. Beware of any truth, so-called, that enables you to ignore the fruit of the Spirit. Beware of anything that endorses sin. God has told us who he is and what he wants us to be. If our discernment is right and true, it ought to be making us more like Jesus, not less like Jesus. We should never be allowed to ignore the fruit of the Spirit in our lives. Notice, this fruit of righteousness that comes from discernment, well, how does the Bible describe that? Well, it describes us as humble, not proud, as gentle, not harsh, joyful, not pessimistic, peaceable, patient, kind, self-controlled, and so on. You know the virtues that God has put in his scripture and says, live into these things, grow in them, become more like them, because through them you become the hands and feet of God, the love of God towards others. This is who we are to be. So the question is, what kind of person am I becoming and do I want to be? As we seek the truth, and we should all seek the truth, as we try to discern what is best and good in the world, do we look like the people that are described in this book? If our pursuit of truth has not led us into more of that, then we are not finding what is true. All right, let's bring it together. Be a jurist, not an attorney. Be a good listener. Get multiple sources. Beware echo chambers. Beware social media. Watch our prejudices. All of these things are important, and all of it requires humility. It requires that we listen more than we speak. It requires that we seek Jesus and become like him, for he is the truth. He is the one who leads us into all truth. With him, we have everything. Apart from him, we have nothing that we need. He is the way and the truth and the life. So we need him constantly. Let's pray.